Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a boxing ring here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today is nobody.
Nobody.
Whatever. which is weird. Usually we get Chandler Levack for these kinds of movies.
It's true.
But I guess Chandler was on vacation. So listeners of the pod will know that means this is a Canadian film.
Yeah, it's not entirely Canadian, but it is certainly got some Canadian funding, that's for sure. It's not directed by a Canadian, but it certainly stars a friend I went to high school with, Leanne Balaban.
Literally amazing. So tell me a little bit about Leanne, because I understand that this was Leanne's first role.
Yeah.
And in addition, she was not really seeking this role out.
No,
right?
she was discovered by a family friend at a Seder, essentially, and said that...
Yep,
that
that's how it happens.
This movie was coming together. There was a script and that she could be great for the lead role. And Leanne, you know... Oh God, my screen just, oh, there we go. Sorry. My screen just went completely black for a second. It's just did it again. Hold on a second, guys. Okay. Sorry about that.
Start from the Seder.
Yeah. So, a family friend at a Seder, said this movie was coming together and that Leanne should audition for it and that she could be great. Leanne was not an actor. She was just, I honestly, we're going to interview Leanne. So we're going to tack on an interview with Leanne to the end of this episode. But so she'll certainly be able to speak more intelligently about this than I will. But I just remember, you know, she had to jump through a lot of hoops. You know how the audition process goes for anybody, but especially for someone without experience, it's that much harder. And I remember when she got the role. I remember when they filmed a fair amount of this, I believe, in Cape Breton, which is in the Maritimes of Canada.
All makes sense to me. Go ahead.
And it's I have not watched this film since it came out. I remember us all going to the theater to see it together, and you know, it's just interesting how like. And you'll see when we talk to her that you know, none of it went to her head. She never, you know, it never sort of kind of, I don't know, warps your sensibility. I imagine that on some degree, getting a role in something like this, thinking, you know, that anything's possible and having a big career after that and all of that, I imagine that it's got to be a little bit overwhelming. But watching this film, and I'm obviously very curious as to your thoughts. I'm sure you didn't even know this movie existed up until 48 hours ago?
No, I mean, we've been talking about it since the beginning of the pod because it's such a unique experience for you to have someone you know go. And one of my best friends had a similar situation when he was around 16, 17. Mm-hmm. He's just a good-looking, charismatic kid. And I was very similar in that a family friend you know, knew him and was like, do you want to be in this movie? And this movie was called Luminous Motion. And it didn't really, it was like a festival movie. It didn't really make anything, but it starred Deborah Kara Unger. Okay. And he was like playing kind of a older bad boy. And the young actor, Eric Lloyd, was kind of the young star of it. Mm-hmm. He's the guy from, I think, the Santa Claus movies and stuff like that.
Sure.
So it was, you know, it had potential to be a thing. And my friend Jamie just, you know, sounds like Leanne just kind of never made a big thing. And he played it out as long as he could play it. He was one of the finalists in contentions for Lucas Black's role in Fast and Furious 3.
Wow.
But when that really didn't happen, he just kind of said, that's not really for me. Mm-hmm. But it is an interesting thing to see someone you know who doesn't necessarily, you know, aspire to be an actor, wind up in a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, because I do feel like, you know, Leanne has had, you know, numerous roles in things since, and I get the distinct impression that, you know, she moved to Montreal. You know, I think she always wanted to, you know, to capitalize on this to some degree or another. But it's just interesting to sort of, it's a time capsule thing, I guess. And it's a window into something that, you know, that it's a fun thing. I mean, I think that this movie, honestly, you know, it's hard for me to be objective about Leanne's performance for all intents and purposes.
Of course, of course.
Because I, you know, but I do think she's very good in this movie. I do think that she has a naturalism about her that comes with first performances by a non-actor.
Well, I totally agree with you. What I thought was really kind of, you know, I actually think Leanne's performance and Leanne's story is maybe the most accessible way into this conversation.
Yeah.
But what I think, what I was so struck by was this is quite a role to give you a first timer.
Yeah.
Because it's, it relies upon their, you know, charisma and their understanding of character and their understanding of kind of, you know, their willingness to underplay things. Cause I think it's necessary that things are underplayed for parts of it. Their willingness to kind of overplay things at points. I was really impressed with her actually. And liked her performance a lot. I also really liked the performance of the other
Tara Spencer.
Yes. Tara Spencer. I thought that was a really strong performance as well.
I actually think the performances kind of across the board are pretty solid. Like, I don't think that if this movie has faults, and believe me, it does. I'm not going to sit here and say that it doesn't. I do think that it's kind of in its pacing. I think that it's a little slow at times, and And I think that the tone is specific, and I'm not sure that the director totally nails it at times, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think my issues with this film aren't so much with the actual content, okay, which I think is fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it does what it set out to do. I think it's a successful movie. My issue is with the ambition and the lack thereof. And it feels like very well-worn ground. Mm-hmm. Story we've seen so many times, so many independent features, you know, Buildings Romans are about this exact thing, you know, a kind of sexual awakening, I need to get out of here. I'm a small town with big dreams, you know, odd relationships with your families. We've seen this so many times, and there was only one element I thought that set it apart from the other kind, you know, the 15 Natalie Portman movies that we've seen like this. And that was, it was definitely prescient in terms of consent, in terms of gender dynamics, in terms of power dynamics, in terms of the way women feel, in terms, like those things really struck me as valuable.
Well, I mean, you could tell that this was written by a woman, first of all. Like, I think that there's definitely, and I agree with everything you're saying, that this film is, what it made me think, like, I thought of like Mermaids, I thought of numerous sort of like early Winona Ryder type performances, yeah, or films.
Winona Ryder more than Natalie Portman, but yes, it was very. They were. I'm sure it was written with one of those two actresses in mind, and they found someone who's very similar to those actresses.
Yes. So no, I agree.
Or Christina Ricci, like,
yes,
that.
Totally, yeah. Totally. Yeah. It has that again. I think that there's. For me, I'd say there was one other thing that made this stand out a little bit for me, and it is the sense of place. You don't see many films that take place in Cape Breton. It did have a very kind of specificity to that. The problem, I think, to your point, is that from a macro perspective, there wasn't a tremendous amount of originality, I guess, in what the film's plot was, you know what I mean? Like, quirky family, quirky girl, who, you know, who feels trapped in her small town and, you know, and wants to get out and all of that. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it also had the element that I could, you know, launch into the sun, which is the relationship with the teacher.
Yeah. I was very curious as to your thoughts on the Andrew McCarthy component of this film.
Well, it's not, I mean, like, again, this is 1999 and the trope hasn't been, you know, worn down to the nub at this point. Right.
Yes.
So it's like, it's at this point, you know, irrespective of how gross it is, because it is gross at the, and I think that's where a lot of people's like kind of blanching from now. And for those who haven't seen it, you know what it is. It's a, you know, a unique and talented and interesting, introspective 15-year-old girl who is, you know, kind of intellectually brilliant but socially awkward, finds some comfort in the, you know, metaphorical arms of her teacher. And there's always a subtext of they want more. And
I mean, this movie straight up says it at one point.
At the end, it does. Yes. And then I was going to get there. But throughout this film, there is this, you know, the sense of longing between these two. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there was a time when that wasn't so revolting and abhorrent. But that's not really like what bothers me, because like there's certainly a way to tell that story. I mean, they just did with a teacher on Hulu, and you know, obviously that's gender reverse. But there are ways to tell this story that, you know, have cultural value and are, you know, compelling for the audience. at this point, we've seen it so many times. It is not something that happens that often in real life. This is not, you know, going to the fucking prom. So need for people who write things about, you know, unicorn children to be appreciated by the one, you know, young, hot, sexy teacher and have this, you know, this quasi-sexual relationship that sometimes turns sexual, often turns romantic, is just, I want to make this clear. It is a moral turnoff, mm-hmm. but like more critically for me right now, it is a narrative turnoff, right? Yeah, it does nothing for me narratively.
So. No, I fully agree with you. I remembered it when I hit play on the movie. I was like, because I knew Andrew McCarthy was in it. I vaguely remembered their relationship. I actually do think that they have an interesting chemistry for what it's worth. Their first scene together in the classroom is a good scene for what it is. The issue ultimately becomes with where it goes, as far as I'm concerned. If it had stayed at that place between the two of them, I might not have had, I mean, subtextually it was there, but how overt it becomes to me was just like, okay, come on.
I guess like, what's the point?
Yeah.
So I guess like I this is really for me. This is not so much about New Order for a girl. This is about this Trump. Mm-hmm. I guess for me, what's the point? Because I think more often this might be a ridiculous overgeneralization, but or misreading of pop culture at large. But more often, I feel like when you have a teacher. In a movie like this, mm-hmm. a independent-minded, not necessarily independent movie, but an independent-minded film about coming of age, mm-hmm. the teacher in some way is usually, you know, macking on the student or trying to get with the student as if that is it's not even a question of whether it's, you know, it's common, but as if that's compelling. And it also, like, to me, demonizes a really noble profession.
Underpaid, underloved profession that I feel, you know, we just don't do enough to, yeah, I hear you.
And I think, you know, it's interesting. The new Gossip Girl, for those who don't know, it's ruined in the first 15 minutes. The new Gossip Girl, or is a conglomeration of underpaid, angry, bitchy teachers, which is interesting to me in theory, particularly because this is Gossip Girl and not in any way an attempt to you know feel like real life, but.
And because Tavi Gevinson is the lead teacher and she's great.
And there's the best part of the show. Meta aspect to that. And, you know, but it's this common trope of teachers being, you know, lame ass student wannabes.
Yeah, it's insane. It's crazy.
Just what it feels like to me. It's this idea of like, why would you become a teacher unless you can't get over high school and you still like secretly want to, you know, date the students. It just happened in fucking Booksmart. Yep. In Booksmart, which is, you know, held up as this, you know, this feminist manifesto. The character played by, who was it? Amber Ruffin? It wasn't Amber Ruffin. It was
I can't remember which character. Yeah, I know what you're talking about though.
Was it Sudeikis,
the teacher?
No, yeah, but I'm talking about the black female teacher. Zamita, the one from Saturday Night Live.
Oh,
Sasheer Zamita.
Yeah,
this is embarrassing.
I mean, we can cut this.
Please cut it all out. Her name is. Fuck. Oh, no, it's Jessica Williams. All right, so she's not from Saturday Night Live. She's from The Daily Show.
Yeah.
But it was Jessica Williams is playing. All right, so in Booksmart, Jessica Williams is playing this, like, hot teacher who just wants to go and hang
students.
With the kids.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy.
And have sex with kids. And that's the idea. It's just like, It's crazy to me and annoying and disappointing. You know, in my high school, you know how much we thought about teachers? Zero. In terms of our social lives, zero. And if anybody if anybody considered introducing a teacher, even a quote unquote hot teacher, into our social lives, you'd be like, you're psychotic. Get this fucking narc out of our party.
You know? I'm gonna play devil's advocate just for one quick thing, which is that I did have a teacher. I had a science teacher who was probably in her early 30s. Mm-hmm. And
so she was 100 in high school.
Sure. Yes. But
let's keep that in mind.
She did, okay. But she didn't seem like 100 1,000. The other teachers. <That's>, exactly. And she had a tattoo on her scalp because she used to have a mohawk. And she would part her hair and we could see this really elaborate tattoo that she had on her scalp. She was a cool teacher. She was a teacher that I felt like...
Did you call her Teach?
We didn't call her Teach. But I say this cool just to say it's the only slight instance I've ever had in my life that even remotely comes close to what you're talking about, and it still
doesn't. Let's talk about teachers. Let's talk about teachers. You have friends who became teachers?
Jesus. Probably. Yes. Yes. Do you?
Sure. Okay. I know a bunch of people who work in schools in one way or another, whether there's teachers or coaches or guidance counselors, school psychologists, people in preschools, things like that. And having known them when they were younger, they're not known people from high school or college who went into this profession. They're not necessarily people that I would love to have my children
taught by, or in
their control or under their supervision for a period of time. But to a teacher, all of whom were partiers or drinkers or fun people,
sure,
I expect none of them to be dirty or weird or secretly pine after a student or sneak up on a house party with students. You know, this is just not a thing that, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm guessing that there are people listening to this being like, oh no, we had a teacher. We had a teacher who would come to our party and play flip cup with us. but those teachers, I don't think it is that. I don't think it plays like that. And it certainly isn't like they're the cool kids. And I also think it's just fucking lame and weird and I hate it. So this is a
I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think that there's clearly a metatextual commentary in Andrew McCarthy's casting, first and foremost, coming obviously from the Brat Pack and all that kind of stuff. There is that.
And we should note, he's the great Andrew McCarthy.
He's the great Andrew McCarthy. We love Andrew McCarthy on this podcast.
He's the best.
I actually do think that he does the best he can to make this palatable, make this as least creepy as possible. I think
very hard with those sideburns.
Very hard with
very those unfortunate sideburns.
He has unfortunate sideburns. I do think that Cecil, which is the character he plays, is an interesting character. I'm not in any way suggesting that I'm okay with his love for Mooney, but do you sort of know what I'm getting at? That this character is a little bit, it's got a little bit more going on in it than it could have.
Here's what I would say.
Yeah.
About two-thirds, maybe even three-quarters through the movie, he essentially professes his love for her.
It says, not I love
in,
you, yeah.
Yeah. So not in a, John Cusack, holding the boombox kind of way. Mm-hmm. In a very matter-of-fact scene at a bar where he just says, I love you, you know that, or something along those lines, right? And it's horrible. And
It's
horrible and it's upsetting and it sucks. I would have preferred the opposite, which we've seen this in movies too.
Sure.
But just that feels so much more palatable to me And the trope I want to see undercut, and again, this is 22 years ago, so, you know, what do they know? But the trope I want to see undercut is this idea that every youngish, good-looking teacher is secretly, you know, kind of horny for their students. I don't like that idea. What I think I would have preferred is Mooney to feel like that's what it is.
Yeah.
And have that never actually be what it is. And what he really wanted is what you hope your teachers want,
yep,
is for you to succeed as students, which is what he's doing, right? He ultimately is trying to get her into this arts academy in New York. But there's this kind of pervasive undercurrent of, is it because she's good or is it because he finds her, you know, attractive or alluring, and or he's trying to gain favor with her so he can, you know, rape her. And which is, you know,
yeah, it does
what he's, what,
yeah,
he's maybe trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it hurts the movie. It hurts her character. It hurts any audience's ability to look at this character and say, okay, this is someone we think is, you know, brilliant and has nothing to do with her gender or her age or her vulnerability. It's just because of her ability. It seems like it's a shorthand way of saying, we're not your normal teen movie. And that's the thing I think that's happens a lot with this thing,
that's,
is
interesting,
that is, once we include teachers in social situations, particularly sexual situations, it does seem like a shorthand way of saying, all right, we're a little grittier, we're a little tougher, we're a little more real world than your Cluelesses or your Mean Girls or your, mm-hmm, American Pies or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We are dealing with real world shit now, with grownups with real problems. And, you know, grownups whose real problem is, how do I fuck my students, ultimately is not that fucking thrilling to me. So that's...
I do think
does hurt this movie. And ultimately, I don't think it maims this movie, because it's not a huge, yeah, part of this movie. Mm-hmm. It's a huge part of what I'm taking from it right now. But, you know, when you move past this to essentially Lou, her friend who moves from New York, who becomes almost a avenger for girls who are taken advantage of in the city.
Yep.
That gets interesting to me,
mm-hmm,
and plays on some themes that I don't think are overexposed even now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot more to that's, you know, makes this movie, I think, a worthwhile watch.
Yeah. I mean, two things. The first is, you know, just to close the loop on the teacher thing, I'll say this. I do feel like there's an interesting story to be told about why a teacher might cross lines with students. As you mentioned, a teacher, the FX show, I think, did a pretty good job at that, in terms of unpacking those situations. I also just feel like there is a gender component to it as well, right? There's this idea of sort of like the lecherous male teacher that's preying on the young female students, that trope does feel incredibly well-worn at this point.
I want to say the adjectives you used, I don't think are ever ascribed to those characters. Adjective and verb. Lecherous, I don't think he's lecherous. And praying, don't get me wrong, I do think he's lecherous and I do think he's praying.
Okay, okay, okay.
But I don't think that he's portrayed as lecherous.
Correct.
I don't think it's portrayed,
correct,
as praying. I think that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I agree. Yeah.
I think that's the issue. The issue is it's presented to me as another relationship. Now,
yes,
the movie that does this the worst, and it's not a teacher relationship, but the worst offender of this of all time is Beautiful Girls.
Yes.
Where that relationship between Timothy Hutton,
yes,
and
Natalie Portman yeah,
is presented to me as a adorable, yeah, meet cute between neighbors,
yeah,
who are helping each other, you know, through a crisis.
Aren't they adorable?
aren't they adorable? And like, I don't mean to like call him out, but I distinctly remember Bill Simmons writing a column on that movie and saying the reason that works is because all men want to fuck Natalie Portman at that time. And that was in ESPN. Now, I may be a little wrong and like, you know, take it with a grain of salt that he may have also been talking about The Professional, but it's the same fucking idea. And I think that when we've seen this with Roger Ebert's reviews of American Beauty, and I think that there was this idea in the 90s and into the 2000s that like wink and nod, like we get it. There's an age of consent, but like it's okay to be keeping tabs on the 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds who one day are going to be the girls you can like.
I mean, there were websites that would count down to the legality of these you know young female actors.
The mere fact that there was a magazine called Barely Legal, and that there's still idea like Barely Legal, you know, like subsections on porn sites, speaks to how much of an idea this is that it is wink and nod, you know, we'll look away. Okay. It's essentially going, you know, 12 miles over the speed limit to lust after young girls.
Yep.
And what I'm getting at is like, there is no judgment of an Andrew McCarthy in this movie, negative judgment.
No. He's a hero by the end of this movie.
You have to be judging these characters negatively. So, like, I'll give you an example of something that I think weirdly works.
Okay.
Well, look, Lolita weirdly works, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not. Yes.
That's book. You mean the book, or you mean the movie?
Every Lolita, both Lolita films and Lolita the book, because obviously, you know, Humbert Humbert is not a hero. But is that his name, Humbert Humbert?
Yep. I think it's Hubert.
No, it's Humbert Humbert.
Humbert. Okay, there you go.
But the song "Don't Stand So Close to Me" by The Police is a 3.5-minute distillation of what I think the movie could be.
Yep.
Where someone is really struggling with the fact that they have these feelings and desires that are immoral and disgusting to themselves, and they are having a hard time pulling back. Because then you get into the really good shit, like Little Children.
Yep.
Right?
Totally. I feel like this, in a weird way, this film is kind of, this relationship particularly, is neither fish nor fowl for me. It makes it, first of all, either pull way back and make it all subtextual and let us just stew in what it feels like we're kind of reading into this relationship and that no lines are crossed. Mm-hmm. Or to some degree, your point with Lolita is a good one, right? Where it's like, go then just, you know, fully commit to the idea of this man fully grappling with these, you know, impure thoughts and really kind of dig into that. But it's not really doing either of those things.
Because I think we've lost. I think at this particular moment in history, 1999, we kind of, and American Beauty is a fucking really good example of this as well.
Yes.
We've completely got lost in the weeds of how immoral it is. That's the thing that happened. Like, we just got lost in the weeds.
Totally agree and with you.
Yeah. Some weird, it just got, it, like, society just got so fucking weird. And I'm not saying it wasn't like this before. Obviously, this has always been kind of a thing, but it got mainstreamed.
Yes.
You know, it got just mainstreamed in a way where people were just like, yeah, this is just another way people have relationships now. Like, even like on a show like Friends, where Ross starts, you know, dating his student who was, you know, an undergrad. And again, it's legal, but it's fucking creepy.
Yeah.
This happened in society with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Well, that was that's the big thing, right? Like, that's the real like lightning rod of that.
Mainstreamed where the enlightened thought was, what happens in a person's marriage, what happens between two consenting adults is fine. Like, these are not questions you're allowed to ask, and that is like you know, that's creepy on two levels, but it plays into this as well, because the issue with that, even if you want to say Monica Lewinsky was of age and is a consenting adult, the issue, of course, is a power dynamics one. He Absolutely. Was her boss.
Yeah.
And a teacher has the same kind of power over the student. See, Andrew McCarthy's character doesn't actually wield it, but he had the opportunity to pull back his recommendation at any time. There was certainly a darker version where Andrew McCarthy says, you know, look, I love you and I want you. Mm-hmm. And if you want this recommendation, you know, you'll sleep with me or something along those lines. And that was like that. That's always kind of hanging out there. And Mooney had to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, there is an interesting scene between them. I would argue perhaps the best scene in the film is the scene when they're walking on the beach together and she has been accepted into this school, but doesn't know how she can extricate herself from the town in order to go to this school. And she's essentially going to Cecil for some sort of guidance or some sort of help. And he kind of just says, like, I can't help you. I got you into the school. I don't really know what you want from me outside of that. Like, he almost kind of says, like, I just don't really understand our relationship and I don't really know what you want from me. And she kind of says the same thing to him. Like, it's an interesting scene because it actually kind of treads in waters that the film doesn't really go to outside of that. Like, I like it because it's a gray scene, right? Like, the problem with the rest of their scenes is they're just so binary. They're just so, like, I love you, stop being weird. Like, Mooney is rejecting him at every turn, just to be abundantly clear. Like, she is not into him in that way. And even their kiss at the end felt theatrical in order to get her what she needed, as opposed to actually feeling as though she had any feelings for him. It's kind of a weird thing. Cause again, like it's non-committal. I don't really think they know what they want to say about this relationship. But I will say that I do think arguably the best relationship in this film is the one between Mooney and Lou. And I wish the movie does dedicate a fair amount of time to them, but there's a part of me that wished that I knew Lou a little bit better, and that I had a little bit more time with the two of them. But I don't know what you think.
I felt like for a large portion of this movie, it was Lou's movie.
Yes.
And I thought Lou's arc was really interesting.
Yes.
I also thought her drive was really interesting too. She kind of came into this town with her New York swagger, daughter of a boxer, and you know, saw all these girls getting taken advantage of and thought she could do something about it. And she did. Now there's this Catholicism element to it I don't really get.
Yeah.
Nor do I really care for, but it doesn't really matter. The idea being if you're, you know, so she's punching these guys. And I guess the idea is she knows how to punch. but you will only go down if you're guilty.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. So,
that's what the movie needs that. So that's what that is.
Right. And like, it's just, I don't know. It kind of undercuts her ability as a puncher and it's this, but like, I just kind of let it go. And I guess the thing I liked about it was this idea. There was a show, a somewhat beloved show, but it was only a one season show on MTV called Sweet Vicious.
Yeah, great show.
Which Jen Caitlin Robinson, who was, you know, now a big director and writer, but it was her first thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, the idea behind that show, for the people who don't know, is basically like two college women taking revenge on men who have sexually harassed, abused, or raped girls on campus. And I think this is kind of a beta testing version of that. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem I have with this version is the loose stuff is very clear to me.
Yeah.
I don't really get the Mooney part of it, going up to guys.
Yeah, so Mooney starts to kiss a bunch of guys to seem like she's promiscuous. It's a long con insofar as that she eventually thinks, I can pretend I'm pregnant, and if I'm pregnant, my parents will let me leave town. But it's circuitous, to say the least, and you don't get the impression that that's really her plan up top. So the plan seems to just be essentially to just change the perception of her in town. To what end is unclear.
I think so. I think that's... So I'm wondering if there is a... It almost feels like if I were involved with this movie.
Yes.
At some point, if I was involved on the you know, development of this movie.
Yes.
At some point, I would have said, the relationship between these two girls is the movie. They are taking back control, and let's focus on that. Let's totally. Focus on a way to kind of scare these boys straight, mm-hmm. In a almost promising woman way. Right.
I could agree with you more. I think that the weakest part of this film, and this is not a performance thing, I just think it's ultimately an execution thing. The family stuff just doesn't work, and it eats up a fair amount of screen time. Mm-hmm. She's got a bunch of siblings, and she's got, you know, a quirky mom and dad, and it never fully, I would argue as well, tonally, it feels like a different movie whenever we're in scenes with the family. It feels a little bit too sort of dialed up and a little bit too cartoony at times.
Yeah.
I just think all of that stuff could have been pulled way back. And to your point, they should have just gone all in on the Mooney and Lou storyline.
Seems simple. They're for the taking. I mean, what I wrote was, this is half a good movie and half a good idea. And I think that they really could have taken a hatchet to a lot of the stuff that isn't about Mooney and Lou.
I agree. And also just like the school stuff, it does feel almost like, in an attempt to not seem like another high school movie, they wanted to sort of expand the universe, right? And make sort of the sandbox bigger. But in the process, I feel like, to your point, I think to both our points, they made a weaker film for it, because mm-hmm. it feels as though there's kind of too many moving pieces now. Whereas you could have told a much more concise and a sharper movie had you focused in on the relationship between those two girls.
And you could have devoted all of your story moves to that story.
Yes.
You know, it's funny because this is the exact same setup as like Luca, more or less. Mm-hmm. Luca's a superior film because Luca's just about the relationship between the two boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, Luca's a complicated character, and Luca doesn't exactly know what he wants. And Luca betrays, I forget the other boy's name, but Antonio. Yeah. Luca betrays Antonio at one point, and they have just a unique relationship where they're trying to exactly grapple with who they are to each other and who they want to be and where they want to go and all those things. And that just doesn't really happen in this movie between those two characters, because there isn't the real estate for it, right? Like,
no, I agree.
Lou can't really function as the second half of, you know, the second half of a two-hander. She just kind of has to function as a plot device for Mooney and the other women in town to kind of liberate themselves from this, you know, male dominated, almost, you know, this patriarchal Neanderthalism.
Well, it's funny you brought up Booksmart earlier, and I do think that this film, you kind of wish this film was more Booksmart back in the day, right? In the sense of that it was completely invested in the relationship between these two girls. And by the way, it's not to say that it needs to be them in scenes together all the time. I mean, I think that Booksmart does a good job of creating storylines for them individually that works quite well. It's just, this movie comes to life when it's them. Right? Like when it's them at a party, when it's them, you know, doing a drive down the strip, which is literally like two blocks. And then Lou's like, wait, so now we got to pretend they're different guys. Like that stuff's great. You know what I mean? And I think that unfortunately, it almost, in a weird way, as I was watching it, I was thinking like, this is probably a better novel than it is a movie. You know what I mean? Like I could see this screenwriter sitting down and writing this as a book and really fleshing out all the stuff she wants to flesh out, giving it sort of that weight and allowing you to have all these kind of like this bench of characters. But as a film, it just doesn't work in that way. It just doesn't have the meatiness to the supporting roles. Like I like the dad character. I think he's fine, but I'm also just like, he gets way too much screen time. I'd rather, you know, give that to Lou, but I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's really, we're hitting on the same thing. It needs another pass.
Yeah. I want to give a synopsis of this film for the people that have not seen this.
Yeah.
Mooney, played by Liam Balaban, feels trapped in her small coastal Canadian town, and with good reason. When she told her parents that her teacher, Cecil, had offered her a spot at an art school in New York, her parents forbade her to go. Then Surly Lou, played by Tara Spencer-Nairn, moves into town. It moves into the neighborhood reportedly from Manhattan. She is from Manhattan. I don't know why they said reportedly. After quickly becoming friends, the two girls had to
speak. She's not from Manhattan. She's from
Sorry.
Like Queens, I think, right? Yeah, the Bronx?
Yeah. New York. She's from New York.
Yeah.
After quickly becoming friends, the two girls hatch a scheme to escape their provincial prison utilizing Lou's improbable boxing skills. New Waterford Girls screened at the Toronto International Film Festival on September 12th, 1999, and it would go on to make $774,469. Nice. I love how specific that is to the dollar. New Waterford Girl has 92% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 85% from audiences. I mean, we've hit a fair amount of the plot. There's not a ton of plot to talk about, but there is some stuff I want to hit along the way. But yeah, go ahead.
I want to ask you a question.
Please.
No, I give this movie a positive, you know, score.
Sure.
But sure. Why do you think this kind of movie always seems to get good reviews? Because, like, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're
like,
saying.
I wonder what that is. Now, I know that sounds almost like I'm being willfully ignorant as a person who is giving it a good review myself. But why is it that this movie is, you know, not a 92% fresh movie?
I think it's a symptom of a couple things. I think that, and I think you and I feel the same way, which is that when a writer and a director, and quite frankly, a studio or investors decide to make a complex, heartfelt movie about coming of age, it's going to hit a sweet spot to some degree or another with intelligent people, right? People that it's not even a nostalgia thing, but I think it's just taking a real swing at trying to understand those years in your life, I think is going to sort of resonate with people one way or another. Mm-hmm. I also just don't think they make that many of them is kind of the thing too. So when they do kind of happen, I think everyone's just like, yes, like Booksmart's a perfect example of that, right? I mean, I like Booksmart. I think Booksmart's a good movie. I don't think necessarily I would have given it the unbelievable reviews that it got at the time. I just think people are just excited when something like this happens because it's kind of rare.
So I think Booksmart's I agree with you exactly. I think Booksmart's a very good movie. Yeah. And Booksmart almost isn't what I'm talking about.
I know.
Right, so Booksmart is a studio movie. I mean, it's not, but it is. I mean, Booksmart is a movie let me put it differently. Booksmart's a movie from 2020 or 2019 or whatever it is. Things are different now. Mm-hmm. This is a movie that probably emanated from, you know, the laptop of a first-time screenwriter who had an idea. I want to write about my life. I want to write about my childhood. I want to write about what it's like to grow up as a young girl in a, you know, far off Canadian town and dream big. Everybody has that idea, right? Everybody has that idea. Now, that's not a bad thing, right? What you know. But my working thesis is the ones that actually get in front of critics are just the best of those ideas. That there are.
Yep. I agree with that.
Dozens, if not hundreds, of movies like this made every year that are, you know, in film festivals, in shitty film festivals, or rejected altogether from film festivals. Very few of them actually get bought at film festivals, get any kind of release, and wind up in front of critics. And those are the top 1% of movies like this. Yeah. Now, even those,
yes,
very often to me, are a little rote and uninspired. And I could see how this works and it's professional and it's, you know, it's certainly super competent and there are aspects of it that are, you know, novel.
Yeah.
But in general, almost universal acclaim seemed wild for a movie like this to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, and you know, I hope that everyone takes our you know, quoting Rotten Tomatoes critics or their scores, that is, with a grain of salt, because, you know, as we all know, they can be based on 10 reviews, they can be based on 200 reviews, they can be based on...
I was just looking up how many this is based on, and this is based on 12 reviews.
Right. So again, right, like the same with the audience scores. We all know, you know, what transpired with Last Jedi and any number of bots that can try to fuck with audience scores as well. So take all of this with a grain of salt. But your grander point, I agree with Kenny, which is that by and large, it feels like movies of this ilk do tend to do quite well with critics. I think part of it just has to do with, people just like a heartwarming coming of age movie. I think that this film for all of my issues with it, I do think that kind of sticks the landing in the end. I thought the last scene was a nice scene. I like this movie's message when it comes to, at least when it comes to Mooney and Lou. I kind of like what it's saying most of the time.
Well, Brian Webster of the Apollo Guide.
Sure. I don't know what that is. But sure.
I don't either. Okay. He's one of the few guys with an actual quote on Rotten Tomatoes.
Cool. What does he have to say?
Sweet, if not profound, with several laugh out loud moments and a wonderful portrait of place. I think Brian Webster nailed it.
I think he did too. Yeah.
Now the larger issue is,
yes,
in our content, in our content waterlogged society.
Yes.
Right now, where we are just overwhelmed with shit to watch, yeah, where I can't even watch things I've been wanting to watch for years. You know, where I literally have a list of hundreds of movies that I plan on getting to at some point, to say nothing of like A Quiet Place 2, you know, to say nothing of like Space Jam 2,
sure,
shit that like is coming out that I just, you know, in the Heights, which I didn't watch in the first week and I'll never watch. What place does a movie like this have? Like, what place does Sweet But Not Profound have?
You know, I in the current landscape that we live in, not much. You know what I mean? I think that this particular film would not get made today. I don't imagine.
But it might get made, right? Because, like, you know, you're still gonna. It might get made. Well, it's a bigger question of what does get made mean, and what does get made entail, and what are the barriers to getting made mean? And I think that's because it's an interesting point you make, because, all right, would not get made, of course, it wouldn't get made by a studio, right? And probably wouldn't get made by a streamer. Does it get, like, is there a financier out there willing to put $1 million up to make a movie like this? Like, probably.
Maybe. I'm curious as to whether Leanne has any insight into this in terms of how the film came together, you know, financially and otherwise. You know, there are some names in this. I think part of the thing too, and, you know, not to get into a grander discussion about the film industry at large right now in terms of distribution, but, you know, there used to be a straight-to-video thing, you know what I mean? And we do have VOD now, and we do have sort of some components of that. So there are lots of movies that get dumped on iTunes, I assume, monthly, that you and I don't even know about, that might even turn a profit depending on how many people rent them or buy them. I just don't know if that's a legitimate revenue stream or not at this point.
There are tons, yeah, but they're all genre films. Right.
Yeah, the action movies or what have you. Yeah.
Well, the horror movies, yeah, or, you know, I mean, I think they're like 50 straight to Shudder movies.
Either. Right. It would not be this. It would not be a coming of age movie about a girl in Cape Breton.
Yeah. All right. So this is the bigger question.
Yeah.
And this is what I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Yeah.
I think people are up on this straight to Shudder market. right? I think people are up on this like Netflix putting out these, you know, schlocky thrillers and stuff like that, and the straight to VOD things, and the you know, the action movies that only Tom Lorenzo watches. But but is there a market for everything else, right? Because I'm not the first guy to say Blumhouse for romantic comedies, Blumhouse for drama. Yeah. Why has that happened?
You know, it feels inevitable to some degree or another.
It does, right? But Blumhouse has been around for 15 years now.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
I mean, that is a bad example. Like, is that what Neon's doing? Is that what A24 is doing? Is that already? I know they're usually acquiring.
Yes, yes.
But is that what they're doing? Like,
well, A24 is you know, legitimately producing things.
Yes, that's true.
Not to say that Neon isn't a legitimate source. It is, but they do tend to, you know, they're grabbing stuff from festivals and what have you, and distributing them. You know, I think to answer your bigger question, I still, and I think that the pandemic has only dialed this up to 11, which is that we just don't really know what this is going to look like in 10 years. I really just don't think we do. I think the theaters will exist. I think people are still going to go and see big studio tentpole movies. I think
sure,
that stuff
we're about to buy one.
Exactly. But I do think that, to your point, I think that you're going to see movie streamers or what have you becoming very genre specific. Like, I think that Netflix doing this kind of shotgun approach of like everything, people are going to start picking off stuff and start finding ways and lanes to do that. If it is sort of rom-coms, if it is whatever it is, I feel like that stuff is ripe for the taking, and I'm a little surprised that someone hasn't done it already.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Me too.
I think that... yeah, I would also argue too, you know, I don't know if you saw the stats that came out yesterday about Netflix. You know, they lost over 400,000 subscribers in the US and Canada over the last quarter.
Interesting.
Which I think is interesting. I think that I'm not sure how Netflix contextualized it, but they used an interesting word, lumping or lumpy, I think was the word that they choose. It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, did you watch Fear Street? Did you by chance?
No, but I'd like to. But again, you know, this deluge of content, I stand no chance.
Right. I liked them. I quite enjoyed it. But I do think that you make a really good point about how Netflix is just... they're all over the map when it comes to the movies that they make. We've talked about this, you know, at the end of every year, there's a list of all the movies that Netflix made. And I swear to God, I have not heard of 85% of them. And I don't know who's watching them.
But only 15% of them actually have any kind of marketing behind them, like Fear Street, right?
Right.
And then,
right.
Or even get screened by critics. And
right.
It is so hard.
it's hard to even process.
It's hard to wrap your head around. It's people, you and me, who for 20, 25 years knew every single feature, mm-hmm. whether we saw it or not, knew of every single feature mm-hmm. that was being produced, that was in theaters, and could name actors in them and who directed them and who wrote them often and who did the score. Like this thing that we're dealing with right now you know, 800 to 1,000 films, mm-hmm. 500 or more, maybe fucking 700 or more, we just don't even fucking know about.
Don't even register. It's crazy.
Crazy. Particularly as an industry professional, like the idea that these, high class problems, but you have these blacklist scripts, these specs that get sold to Netflix, get made, and it's like it didn't even happen.
I'll take it one step farther. I don't even know how people find these movies on the actual physical interface. If you put me in front of Netflix for 45 minutes, I'm not sure I could find most of these movies. I don't know how people, I'm sure it's an algorithm. I'm sure it has to do with, you know, what type of movies you've watched in the past. You stumbled upon some fucking, you know, whatever Schmageggy movie, and then it just gets, you get more of them sent to you. But I don't know, man.
Have you ever in your life put on a movie on any streaming service mm-hmm. that you hadn't previously heard of?
No.
Do you think people must, right?
I'm assuming. It's never people happened must. To me in my life.
People must. And then part of that is because you, like me, have basically a ever-growing list of shit you have to watch.
And also,
shit you want to watch.
Exactly,
or, you know,
right? Shit that I hear about on various websites, various, you know, publications.
Which I'm including on these lists. Yeah, you have this mental list of, like, yes. You know, sometimes there's a Netflix movie that breaks through, like, you know, To All the Girls I Loved Before, The Boys I Loved Before, or whatever.
And, I mean, I know The Kissing Booth exists. I'll never watch it, but I know that it exists.
Right, but exactly. Yeah. The Kissing Booth could conceivably be on your list. Right?
Right.
Or someone great on your list, right? Yes. Because it got some, you know, play in Vulture and got some play in IndieWire or whatever it is.
Right.
There are 80 other fucking movies on Netflix that no one knows about. I don't know what websites they're being talked about. And the only people who could potentially watch them are people who have sat home all during the whole pandemic and watched everything on Netflix. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's so funny right now. Like, are you getting, is your Netflix telling you to watch Startup?
No, but I have Netflix telling me to finish stuff, which I hate. They'll send me an email being like, "Don't forget to finish this." And I'll be like, "Do you think I?"
Yeah, I made the decision.
I made the decision not to fucking finish that. But I want to. This is an interesting idea, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this. So this movie, New Water for Girl, is on IMDb TV, aka Amazon, whatever, however you want to split this. And I think that's great. I would love to know why, right? Like, and I don't say that because I didn't enjoy this film and that I'm not happy that perhaps the people behind this film are making some money off of it. Would love to see that. But I'm just curious as to how these things happen, right? Like, how does a movie like this, which, as we said earlier, didn't crack $1 million in its box office, how does it get onto these streaming services? That is sort of also beyond me, right? Like, we've been doing this for 4 years now, right? And you and I are always very happy when a movie that we haven't seen or need to watch is on these streaming services. And I'd say probably 75% of the time, I'll be honest, it's on one of those streaming services, right? Mm-hmm. Which is great. But sometimes I'm just like, how is this on here? Why is Tubi decided that this movie is on there?
Yeah.
Why is Pluto decided that this movie is? I really don't know the answer. No. What are the metrics? How are they even figuring out why a small movie like this is worth their time or their bandwidth? I don't know.
I have no idea. I mean, part of it is like they all these streaming services need more than you can watch.
Yes.
They need to be an ever-ending mall mm-hmm. that you could never get through. And in order to do that, you just need stuff. Like, that was Netflix in the beginning. Netflix in the beginning just wanted
titles.
To fill the boxes. And they didn't care what it was. Like, truly, they didn't care what it was. Just as long as it felt like there's mm-hmm. always more. You haven't gotten to the end. Now, I think that's true to this too. Like the mere fact that New Water for a Girl can fill a box and it's just another thing. And maybe it's something that 1% of the audience will check in on is almost irrelevant. It just needs to be a box on their ever-ending or never-ending shelf.
There must be some legitimacy to that. I don't mean to suggest that there isn't. I think it's all about libraries. Obviously, that goes without saying. I imagine as well that they reach out to companies and say, like, we would love as many library titles as we can get from you guys. And it's kind of a batch thing. And these smaller titles get kind of folded into these clumps that are perhaps purchased for streaming. I think it's just really interesting. So I want to kind of just unpack a couple things from the film before we wrap this up. The first that I want to kind of highlight a little bit, I know we talked a little bit about Leanne up top, but I do kind of want to talk about the sort of high wire act that is this performance, in terms of the whole movie's on her shoulders. And I think that it works for a bunch of reasons. I think that she is capable of sort of that humility, and she feels very genuine, but I also think she's very funny. I think there's a lot of like really cutting funny moments. I even some physical comedy, the whole gymnastic bar that she face plants straight into.
That was great.
It's a great
that's
beat.
What I really thought. That's when I'm like, this is not something I would just entrust to someone I met at a Seder.
Right. Right. I think that she does a really great job. She just face plants and then she gets back up and says, these aren't my normal shoes. she can absolutely stick those lines. I'd say that the VO actually doesn't totally work for me in the film. I don't know if it worked for you.
No, not really.
It doesn't really, I don't know. It's there. Sometimes it goes away. But I do think that she's very genuine. She's very heartfelt. It's a really good performance from her. And to your point, entrusting this whole film to someone who had never done this before takes a lot of guts. I want to kind of point out as well, there's a couple just scenes where location work does so much for you. Most of them are these beach scenes, but still, like, I think of the scene with Mooney and Lou at the beach with this gray, gloomy, it's like stones all over the beach, them sitting in this boat that's just like landlocked, all this kind of stuff, that the location stuff. And I'm sure you know this better than anybody, but like anytime you could be on location, it's just always going to help your movie, and it's always going to make it feel so much more lived in. And they're so lucky to have these beautiful locations to be able to take these just big old wide shots of just, you know, Nova Scotia and what have you. It's just really, really beautiful. And I think it goes a long way to imbuing this film with it. I would argue that for me, 20% or 20 percentage points for me just come from how beautiful the locations are and from just the feeling of this small town.
Totally.
We mentioned earlier that there's this great scene where Mooney and Lou go for a drive together, and they drive down the strip, and the strip is basically a block. But like, I love the look of that strip. It just feels so real. There's a stunt, I'm assuming, which caused most of their budget to push a trailer off of a cliff, which is shot not great. It's very oddly choreographed. I also just want to say for a second, the director of this film, whose biggest credit is Empire Records, is a good movie. What are your thoughts on Empire Records? Are you a fan of Empire Records?
I love Empire Records. I love Empire Records. I don't love that Empire Records has become everybody's favorite little cult thing.
I know.
But I was very much in on Empire Records as a kid.
Right. It's a great movie.
So it was mine, and I don't, you know, that's great that everyone also loves it, but I do. I think it's fucking fantastic.
I love Empire Records. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
And I think that Alan Moyle, who directed this film and directed that film, does have a really good sense of comedy. I appreciate that he took a swing with this. I mean, this and Empire Records do not feel like similar films. You wouldn't have thought that this was from the same guy.
No way. The thing with Empire Records that's too bad for Alan Moyle is no one appreciated it until about 3 weeks ago. So he definitely didn't get any kind of bump off it whatsoever.
And I now totally agree. You know,
70. So, but if that movie, and again, that movie has an amazing cast and could have been more of a thing. Like, yep. if you put marketing behind it, gave it a big release, I think it could have been a very kind of big, almost seminal movie.
Yep.
And then Alan Moyle would have a really big, great career. You know, movie it reminds me of in terms of it should have gotten just a big release and just been such a big deal is that movie Band Slam.
Great movie. Great movie.
Great movie that, you know, no one ever really paid any attention yep. to, but there's no reason why not, right?
Yep.
So, yes, Alan Moyle could have been a much bigger deal, but he had to go to Canada and shoot this movie for, you know.
For like $10. Yeah, it's interesting. The Empire Records thing, which was a movie that was constantly on in the video store that I worked in when I was a kid, mm-hmm. it was just a movie that the 20-something girls that worked there just had literally on loop. It was just always on. I think it was one of those films that at the time seemed too quaint and too small or whatever the case might be. But like in my brain, I clump it with Josie and the Pussycats. I clump it with like Can't Hardly Wait, with like those type of movies. Those movies, which are great films, but like I don't know why Empire Records just didn't connect with people when it came out, but just didn't.
Like Can't Hardly Wait was in the middle of the teen boom.
Yes,
had established stars and got a release. Yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned two movies by the same director, but
yes, I did.
Josie and the Pussycats had a huge release and was just not
just bombed. Yeah.
Just misunderstood. Like people just didn't get it, and you know, I don't think anyone really botched that. I think it was just kind of you know ahead of its time, and now everyone understands what a masterpiece it is.
Yeah,
Empire Records just didn't really even get a chance.
Yeah,
you know, which is why I'm looking at it right now. It had a $10 million budget, Warner Brothers movie.
Yep.
Like, what happened here
with Liv Tyler? By the way, at a time when like Liv Tyler was Liv Tyler, like she, yeah, not that she doesn't mean something now, but like she was
not really, dude. I mean, it was 95.
Oh, so it was before she really popped.
Yeah,
so she's like basically just been in Aerosmith videos at this point,
pretty much. I mean, you have all these people who rule, right? You have Anthony LaPaglia, who rules. Robin Tunney, who I think this is before The Craft. Renee Zellweger before Jerry Maguire.
Yep.
Lev Tyler before, you know, Armageddon or whatever it was. I do think it was Rory Cochrane after...
Dazed and Confused,
After Dazed and Confused.
Yep.
But, you know, Ethan Embry before...
Can't Hardly Wait.
Can't Hardly Wait. And this could have been the movie that popped all of them. It's such a great film. It's such a funny film.
Yep.
It's just a great little moment too. Record stores and, you know, Damn the Man and Save the Empire and all that stuff. It should have fucking ruled. It should have been a big thing. And like, I guess it is in the end of the day. In the end of the day, like, it matters a lot more than like, I don't know what mattered in 1980. Matters more than She's All That.
I agree.
I think.
Although, that's interesting. I do think that some of these movies just age better than others, right? Like She's All That, which by the way, there was a clip today of the He's All That Netflix film that's coming out next month. Yep.
That, by the way, like this is the weird thing about nowadays. He's All That has been a big kind of like, you know, inside baseball story for two or three years, right? They're making He's All That.
Yeah.
Who's gonna write? Who's gonna star in it? Oh, big deal. That movie is gonna get put out on Netflix.
No one will ever know
it. No one's gonna acknowledge it and it will go away.
Yep.
This almost happened with Space Jam 2. If it wasn't for everyone making fun of it, like Space Jam 2 has been talked about for 25 years.
It's crazy.
It's been talked about with LeBron for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets made, it happened, and it's going to go away, and no one will ever discuss it again.
I watched it, man. It's something.
I'm going tonight.
I'm very curious to hear what you think over the course of
this conversation,
yes,
of this podcast. I didn't buy tickets, but while we were on this podcast, we're on an hour and a half in the New Waterford. My twins,
yes,
and my niece, who's 13, are at a drama camp.
Okay,
and it's not going so well for my son, who's who thought he was into it, and now he's the only boy in the cast, and he's like, but he has a great role. He's very happy, but you know, he's just he's struggling.
Okay.
So my niece is allowed to have her phone there, and they're allowed to use it at lunch. So they just texted me that he's having a hard time. So I said, what do you want to do tonight? And he said, I want to go to the theater and watch Space Jam 2. So I guess that's what we're doing.
That's what you're doing.
So I'll report back tomorrow.
I'm going to be fascinated to hear what you think of it. But I agree with you 100%, Kenny, that these, you know, he's all that. It's been talked about for years. Years we've been talking about this thing. And this is how we're going to get it. I don't know. I'm very curious to see... yeah, Empire Records. I got to rewatch Empire Records now. It's a great movie.
You know when this thing we're talking about really hit me as like nothing, you know, like it's no longer actually even about the movie anymore. Mm. Like the this is a thing that's happened in football and basketball and sports in general, where the off season has become more exciting for a lot of people than the season.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Look, yes, last night when we're recording this, the NBA Finals just ended.
Yes.
Today, this morning, I mean, there's a little bit on Giannis winning, but there's a lot on like, what's Chris Paul going to do next? Like, the offseason has started. Like, what's the next step for Chris Paul? Dude, he's just in the finals.
Yeah. Like, he did pretty well.
So I think like now, like that's happening in movies. It's there's a lot of like, what's the next big movie? What's going to happen? Like, we're so excited for this next thing. When it comes out, no one even gives a shit. What I was going to say is when this really like hit for me, again, these are two very bad movies, okay. But people for a long time talked about a Zoolander 2 and an Anchorman 2, and those movies came out and no one cared.
I liked Anchorman 2. I know that's crazy, but no, I thought it was either, I mean, I don't remember anything about it, but I remember laughing in the theater. I agree with you on Zoolander 2. You can wait too long, man. Like, you know that. As, you know, just like, you gotta hit at the right moment, right? If you wait 18 years to do your sequel, I mean, come on. What are you doing?
Sometimes the long wait works. Like with Blade Runner 2049.
Sure.
And some, or Mad Max.
Does it work with comedies?
Borat.
Borat, that's a good call. You're right. Borat worked. Yeah.
It can't work with comedies to me. It's just a matter of execution. I have no doubt a Zoolander 2 could have worked. I have no doubt an Anchorman 2 could have been a bigger thing.
I don't doubt it either.
Really funny, you know, like they were really good.
I watched the other day that I actually would love to see a sequel to, and I don't know if they'll do it. My guess is they won't, but a Game Night 2 would absolutely be something that I would watch the hell out of.
I'm sure they'll do it.
You think so?
Yeah, it's such a good movie. It's the best fucking movie.
Isn't it so good?
It's the best.
Fucking best.
Well, I just had Rollins watch it. He loved it too. Like, it's like, it's just, I adore that movie. I think that movie is straight up screenwriting 101. And I don't mean that in a bad way. That is the movie you should teach. And
feels teed up for a sequel. Like, you could easily do a sequel to that.
The adherence to the, you know, the overarching theme of games, respect on such a cellular level. Yeah.
The Denzel bit is just tremendous.
So good. So funny.
The moment when she's like, he drove a BMW. Oh, a 3 Series. Oh.
Very funny.
It's a very, very, very
I love Lamar Morris. I love Cali Bunbury. I think that I think that cast just top to bottom is so fucking stacked.
Stellar.
And I
drops the ball.
No, it's just stacked. And, you know, I love Rachel McAdams. She's like, she might be my favorite actress. But what I love is like, all right, so I love Happy Endings, as you know. It's such a great show.
Great show.
And you basically have like 5 killer comedians and you have Alicia Cuthbert.
Yes.
And Alicia Cuthbert is, you know, cast because she's a name and she's out of her depth in the first season. And like midway through the first season, they just figure it out. And like she figures it out, and she becomes the funniest character in the show.
Yeah.
And that kind of is what happens in Game Night, because you have these, like, I mean, Kylie Bunbury is not exactly a comedic actor,
right?
But she's not like, you know, she's not tasked with being like super funny. She's great with what, with, you know, the limited amount of comedy she's given. But Rachel McAdams is not a comedian. I mean, I know she was Regina George, but she's not a comedian,
Kills it.
She is so fucking funny. Like, she is as funny as anybody else in that film.
And like, by the way, like, not just funny in terms of delivery, like, her physical comedy in that movie is just unbelievable. Like, it's funny you bring up Elijah Cuthbert, because she's kind of, in a weird way, sort of, she's the Monica of that series, right? Which is that Courtney Cox is the name.
Is the name.
And it takes her a beat and the writers a beat to figure out, like, where the comedy is with Monica. And then she's really funny.
Monica and Rachel, the funniest characters in TV history. They're so specific. I think I talked about this on our friends podcast. But like, they're just the game of Chandler, the game of Ross, the game of Joey are so out there on Front Street. Like, there's nothing wrong with it, but like dummy, sarcastic, and nerd. I get it. The game of like Jap. I can say that. And the game of like overly competitive woman, like those are the people in my life.
And
also nobody like talks about
like OCD.
Nobody talks about them. Like, I love it. But in like, I like the Phoebe's great too, but Phoebe's, you know, Phoebe's a clown. Yes. Like that's not a real thing. Right. Like the specificity of that and the specificity of Rachel McAdams' character. Like, that's my wife's family.
Yeah.
That is like, you know, like if Laura loses, if Laura loses something to me, like a game of horse or a game of ping pong, and her sisters are there, the scorn they treat her with, like very upsetting for a Levy athlete. Very upsetting. Very disappointing.
Amazing.
It's four sisters and a brother, and they're the most competitive people in the universe. Yeah.
There's a great moment in Game Night too, where Rachel McAdams and Jason Bateman are driving. I think they're literally driving to the game night, and they see the house, and she says something about like, I mean, look at this house. Someone's clearly overcompensating for something. And Jason Bateman goes, no, I've seen his penis. It's pretty great. She's like, I tried. I don't know which one for me. Like, she's like, I did everything I could to try to make you feel better, and it doesn't matter. So like, it's just she is able to throw away a joke. She's able to nail a joke. She's just tremendous. And also, speaking of Jennifer Aniston's delivery, which is fantastic, I've been rewatching Friends at lunch when I'm eating, and
I know it happens at lunch.
Well, I mean, it's a good point. Do you remember? I'm sure you remember the episode, obviously, when Joey's reading Little Women, and he puts The Shining in the freezer because it's too scary. And then at the end, he can't finish Little Women, and she says, "Joey, do you want to put the book in the freezer?" And the way that she delivers it is just like funny but sweet, and just like she's great. She's great.
I know she won the Emmy her last season. So obviously people get it. Like, obviously people get how brilliant she was in that show, but like, it's little things like that. It's her recognition that with Joey, she's the big sister.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
With Chandler, she's the younger sister. Yep. It's this like little thing that's just like so subtle and clever and she's, I don't know. It's
great.
Really, really hard to nail it. And there's, you know, I'm sure on rewatch you're seeing so many things about the show that like did not age so well.
No,
but I hope people ignore them for the stuff that was done brilliantly on that.
Went over to Tia's to watch Cats with a bunch of the Station 19 writers on the weekend. I bring this up because Tia was on our Friends episode. So I was telling her that I was rewatching the show, and I rewatched an episode in particular that really made me uncomfortable, which is, do you remember I'm sure you do, the episode where Rachel injures her arm and Ross has to like put on her makeup for some like thing that they have to go to. And then she's about to take off her clothes and she's like, can you please leave? And he's like, but I've seen you naked. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, but I don't like, you know, it's different now. And he's like, I can see you naked whenever I want. I just have to close my eyes. And then he like closes his eyes and he's like, I can see you naked. And I'm just like, I don't like this. I mean, I think it's, I get why it's
not
funny,
but that's
it's a little bit, it's a little gross.
I'm not buying that. I'm not buying that.
I don't know.
I'm not into that one.
There's just stuff in the show, in particular with Ross's character, that sometimes does bum me in terms of just, but anyway, all that being said, I think that it is, all of this stemmed from this movie. And I think what's interesting about this film and how it connects to what we were just talking about is, great casting, the right people, knowing, you know, what people have inside them and hoping that you can find a way to express that. I think they did a great job with Leanne. I think they did a great job with Tara in this film. I think that this film is pretty well cast across the board. Do you want to rate this movie?
Sure do, pal.
So in 1999, as I mentioned, I saw this film at, I think I might have even seen it at TIFF, but saw it with my friends. Liked it quite a bit. Probably gave it a 75 back then. Like, I don't know that I necessarily was over the moon about it, but I thought Leanne was great. And I was obviously very happy for her. Before this podcast, watching it again, I was a little bit lower. I think it was at like a 70. And now after our conversation, especially, you know, us unpacking a lot of the Andrew McCarthy stuff, I'm a little lower. I think I'm probably at like a 67. That's where I'm at.
Phil? You hit me right on the head. I'm at a 67. Oh, that's where I was before the podcast. I'm going to stay at a 67. I feel like some things are worse than I thought and some things are better than I thought. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think 67 is exactly where I want this movie to live. Yeah, look, it's the problem is it's a good movie.
Yeah.
It lacks urgency and it's inessential. And in 1999, yeah. Not such a big deal. Mm-hmm. In 2021, a much bigger deal.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's a problem with the pacing of the pace of our modern times.
Yeah.
That I desperately want to, or I desperately long for a time in the future when I can get off the fucking treadmill and just chill out and time kind of slows down. But for now, if I'm not doing a podcast on every film that came out in a particular year, I don't have time for movies that lack urgency. And what I mean by that is not lack urgency contextually. I mean, they don't like call out for me to watch them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need to be watching this to kind of, you know, fill some hole in myself or do, you know, like whatever. So it's an inessential movie, but it is by no means a bad movie. It's a good movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I feel very similar. I think that obviously I'm glad I rewatched it. You know, I wish that it had a little bit more oomph to it. I wish it had a little bit more of a spine at times. I wish that, as we said, it aimed more at Mooney and Lou and really kind of just completely committed to that relationship, because I think that that's the heart of this movie. I think that's the best part of this film. But I'm glad I watched it again, and I'm glad that I'm glad that we were able to talk about it. So there you go.
What do you want to do next week?
Yeah, I'm not going to throw out anything, because when we do the interview, we'll just seam it there and we'll
throw to the interview.
We could also throw to it when we do the interview. But yeah, we're going to have Leanne on to talk about, perhaps even Tara as well, to talk about working on this film and what it was like to make it and what it's like to watch it, perhaps if they watched it again recently, to see sort of how it holds up for them and all that. So that's what we have to look forward to.
Stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned for that.
Hey, everyone, we are back with the stars of the movie we just talked about. Believe it or not, we have stars on this show. It's Tara Spencer-Nairn, Leanne Balaban, the co-leads of this fantastic film that we both really enjoyed. Thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I've known Leanne now for over 20 years, which is crazy to say out loud, but it's true. And I feel like we never really talked about the experience while you were even having it. Like, I remember you getting the part, obviously. I remember you going to shoot the movie. I remember you testing for it. I remember you auditioning, doing all the whole process of it. But I guess I just sort of, you know, obviously through the lens of 2021, what was that experience like, having never done anything like this before, you know? And it was, I mean, pretty, it seems effortless. I mean, your performance in the film is great, but I'm just sort of curious as to sort of what it was like, that whirlwind.
I mean, it was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. I actually started auditioning for it when I was 17. So, I mean, I barely had a job when I was 17, let alone auditioning to star in a movie. On so many levels, it was a new experience, like entering the world of work, going to an office building to perform and being filmed, and meeting all of these very interesting adults that I that were involved in the movie business, which I had no experience in, and didn't know, no family or anything like who made movies or were in cinema or TV or anything like that. So just everything about it was novel and exciting. I had been like a high school theater nerd and was in the play. Like, you remember, I always acted in high school and stuff, but I never really considered it a career. Like, I mean, yes, there were movie stars, but like, it's not something you actually could choose to do and have a profession. And like that, it just, especially living in Toronto at the time, didn't seem like something I would ever pursue. I don't know. I was really interested in journalism. I did go to journalism school briefly, but anyway, yeah, it was just so crazy. It was so crazy to be a teenager and just have that opportunity and to keep getting called back. Like, when I was convinced it was terrible, every audition, I was like, no, that was really bad. That was really terrible. Yeah. So it just, you know what though, in hindsight, it had a sense of inevitability to it. Like, just, I was called back about 7 times over the course of almost a year. So it was meant to be, felt like kind of it was meant to be.
Sure.
Wow. Tara, what was your experience getting cast in this movie? The basic research I did shows me it was not your first role, you were obviously a young actor at the time, and it seemed like you had done some stuff before, but
I was like fresh out of film school, Vancouver Film School. I'd been in like a couple shows. I think I'd my big break was a guest star in the TV show called Two. About this guy who was twins. He had an evil twin. It was great show, guys. Really great show. You gotta research
great.
That.
Yeah.
And I auditioned for this. And again, like, I think as any actor auditions, you sort of audition and you're like, okay, see you later. And they had callbacks in Vancouver. And I think I was one of the only people who went in for Lou in Vancouver. And I remember, you know, after the fact, the casting director, John Comerford, actually was honest with me. And I didn't realize, but he was like, no, they asked me to just record you the whole time because the director and producer wanted to get a sense of your personality. Sure. And he was asking me all these crazy questions. And I was talking about getting kicked out of high school, like being suspended. And then I found out that that essentially was like my audition, like part of my audition.
Sure.
But it took a really long time for me to find out because they actually wanted Natasha Lyonne in the role. Oh. And I think they didn't have the money for her. So I remember that summer, I kept having my agent call every week. And he was like, I can't keep calling to see if you're still the first choice. So, you know, they kept calling and said, yep, you're still in the mix. You're still the choice. But they, you know, they were trying pursue Natasha Lyonne. And I've actually spoken to the producers since then. And they're like, yeah, we were trying to get her. Couldn't get her though. I was like, oh, well, thanks.
Yeah. So have you guys watched the film like at all recently, or have you watched it since it came out? I mean, have you sort of taken another look at it?
I went to a screening actually with Jennifer Khawaja. They had a screening at the TIFF. And actually Trisha Fish was there too.
Oh, cool.
Was it Jack? Julia and Jennifer were there. Trisha, It was
the producers and screenwriters.
Sorry, yes. I'm just saying their names. You know.
I'm just curious as to sort of how it holds up. It's interesting because, you know, I saw it back in the day. I can't remember if I saw it at TIFF or when it came out in theaters, but I obviously saw it. And I had not seen it since then. And Kenny had never seen the film when we watched it to talk about it on the episode. And there's a lot of things that hold up incredibly well. And then there's some stuff that obviously it's been 20 some odd years and, you know, we're different people now and we're seeing it through a different lens. And I kind of wanted to talk for a sec about the Andrew McCarthy relationship.
The things that hold up really well are your performances.
Yes. I was going to say, you guys are fucking great.
And also your storylines and your relationship and your dynamic. Yes. The Andrew McCarthy stuff is a little cringy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So cringy.
Yeah, it's a little cringy, yes. Oh, and also, I mean, you know, the photography and it really is a beautiful looking movie. And it's actually a little prescient in terms of consent issues and kind of the Me Too of it and female empowerment and female friendship. So There is a ton about this movie that, like, we loved and were really kind of impressed by, but it was a little kneecapped by this Andrew McCarthy thing. We think he's great.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, we love you guys in it. But Leanne, I'm curious, you know, you guys have an interesting chemistry, it's when it crosses the line into obviously more than just friendship when things become a little cringy. And I guess my question to you is, how did you approach that? Did it seem cringy to you at the time? Did you feel like, did you and Andrew talk about the relationship between these two characters in any way?
You know, because as I said, like everything about this was a completely new experience.
Sure,
I had no barometer for like anything that would be appropriate or not appropriate. But having said that, everything felt relevant to the story that we were telling when we prepared and when we talked about the characters. And I didn't, you know, we do live in such a different world in 2021 that we have denormalized this kind of relationship between teacher student, which is like definitely socially progress. But at the time, I didn't know. I was not like, I didn't have that lens. I didn't have that critical like gaze as a teenager to be able to see that this was a fundamentally inappropriate relationship. To me, I was just living inside the character and inside the world of the story. I think I really did inhabit deeply that sense of like her ambition and tried to relate it to my own life. So I wasn't, I mean, it's even still difficult today, Terry, you could speak to this, like to fully invest yourself in a script, in a part, when you do have those like critical reflections on it.
Yeah.
I think like that still exists to this day. But definitely at the time, like being a naive teenager, I don't think I had that awareness back then. And actually hadn't even considered that aspect of the film until you two brought it up right now, which is obviously true. But like, I just didn't, you know, I didn't have that savvy at that age.
Well, you're not alone.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
What it feels, I mean, Kenny and I talk about it on the episode, you know, at length about sort of what's become kind of tropey about it. I mean, it became a real thing for a long time, certainly within the 90s and early 2000s, of that sort of this power dynamic that existed, and why so many movies sort of trafficked in that stuff.
Somehow, we kind of went through the Rubicon on it, and it became, you know, as you said, Leanne, it became kind of okay. And we've gotten back to the place where it has been denormalized and it's not allowed anymore, you know, appropriately. But I'm actually, weirdly enough, watching a movie from the 80s right now where it's very clear that this is where this relationship is something that happens. And it's very clear that this is not appropriate, that this is not something that can continue a teacher-student relationship. So it was, you know, it was a weird thing, and it's as a young actress, it is kind of unfortunate that no one kind of said, hey, by the way,
Right.
But that's also speaking to the time that it was and when it was filmed, and how things were perceived. And times have changed. And it's been a long time since then. And for me, it really didn't stand out until I saw the movie again a few years ago. And that's when I went, oh, my God, that is really inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, at the time, same with Leanne, it didn't really jump out to me because we were taught to, you know, it's almost as like this misogynistic sort of world that we were brought up in. And that's how it was. And that's what we were taught. And that was a thing that happened in life. And you better be ready, girls.
Like, you know? Yeah.
It's a great barometer to say, look how far we've come. And holy crap, that was really inappropriate. Yeah. And I mean, I see it as like a bad tattoo. You know, you can say you got this bad tattoo when you were 18. And then your way of justifying is, but like, look how far I've come. Look how far we've come, you know?
Sure.
So that's how,
that's
how you're like, it's a reminder of where we once were.
Yeah.
You can contrast all of that with your character, Tara Lou, who kind of came into this town almost as an avenging angel, right? Yeah. And was very eyes wide open about the way the women of this town were kind of, and kind of women in general, but the women of this town were being used and kind of cheated upon and that whatnot by the young men of this town. And I thought that was really interesting too. And how did that feel playing that character and, you know, kind of being on the leading edge of that idea?
Well, that character also came from a lot of hurt and pain where she suffered the same sort of abuses from her own father and watched that abuse go down in her own family. So that sort of angel, should you say, like where Lou comes from is a lot of pain and hurt. And she wants to, for me, the way I saw it is like whatever she can do to help her mother and help make this right. Like get away from where she was and how can I make this right? And that was really the through line, I feel like, for this character. But, you know, she's a really broken character who's damaged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, Leanne, in terms of Mooney's character, you know, Kenny and I talked a little bit about, you know, sort of a Winona Ryder kind of vibe that she has, a little bit of sort of that I thought of Mermaids. I thought of like there were films that sort of came to mind when it came to Mooney's character. Were there sort of touchstones for you? I know that, I mean, obviously it was your first performance, but were there inspirations? Were there things that you thought about as you were doing the role?
In preparation, Alan Moyle, the director, showed me the film Margaret's Museum. And Helena Bonham Carter's performance wasn't directly an influence, but certainly like in terms of the way she related to the camera, that was something that I studied, like the way that she angled her face or she held her body. So there was more of like maybe a bodily preparation, like just the way that Mooney would like inhabit her skin. I think they probably wanted Winona Ryder and the star in this movie.
But I mean, Ryder and Natasha Lyonne.
That would have been an awesome movie.
Yeah, that would have been the
ultimate 90s movie.
But instead, it was us.
I wanted to ask about your relationships. You guys obviously didn't know each other prior to this, and the characters didn't know each other either. But by the end of the film, you really do feel this bond. You really do feel this closeness between the two of them. You know, how did you guys approach, you know, your friendship, your relationship, you know, within these relationships of Mooney and Lou?
I feel like it was art imitating life, imitating art. Like, you were the experienced actor coming onto the set. You were giving me all this advice and wisdom. You took me under your wing. You explained all the vocabulary to me. I clearly remember you just helping me navigate this world. Like, okay, when they say back to ones, that means we're going back to our marks. Mark, by the way, mark is like the tape on the floor. You have to hit your mark when you're on camera. We're number ones. Number ones because we're like the cast. That's the talent. Like, I just remember being so grateful that I had this kind.
Nice. That's adorable.
Partner. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think everything flowed from like our real life synergy. It wasn't hard to to spark that, you know, in our characters.
And
I feel like
they truly
hired like the people who are the characters. And I think that just automatically, like, I'm also just like outgoing and exuberant and I want to have fun and I want to party. And I'm like, you can't go to bed yet. We're going to stay up. And it just, I think it just came organically and naturally. And I feel like that's why they did take so long in the casting process and did want to cast it in sort of a unique, different way. That was a lot of that, I think, was Alan Moyle. And he really did, like, remember the bubble? I need you to come into the bubble, girls. Come into the bubble. Right. He was always about the bubble. But I remember also just being in awe of Leanne and almost jealous of Leanne at this girl who had, like, never done this in her life and was honestly killing it.
It's remarkable.
And I remember just sitting there going, what the fuck am I doing?
Babe, that's so
going
kind.
To get what am I? Fuck. Like, it was just so organic and natural. And I'm sitting there going, I am trying so damn hard here.
But you guys were both fantastic. But I do want to piggyback on that a little bit, because one thing that I kept thinking throughout the movie, knowing that this is your first role, Leanne, was... I never would have trusted a first timer with that role. It's nothing about that role. And you were so good. And that my point is, like, it was amazing, but nothing about that role and your performance in it is innate. It's nothing is obvious. Like, it's not like any other characters. It's not really a Natalie Portman role. It's not really a Winona Ryder role. Like, there's a like an edge and a almost like, almost like a nihilism to it that you don't really see with those characters. And it was kind of amazing to watch you pull that off. Like, there was the moment where you fell in the gym got right back up.
Yeah.
that could have been out of a Wes Anderson movie.
Totally.
It it had a Rushmore vibe to it. Like, that's actually kind of more than anything. Like it was like a female Jason Schwartzman performance. There's just nothing innate about that. So really, really amazing. I love that.
You should have won. At the time, it was a Genie for that. I never really understood that. I feel like we split the vote.
You were nominated.
Oh, we weren't.
It wasn't.
You weren't even nominated.
I don't think so.
That's shit. Really? That's junk.
Well, I wanted to. You guys shot most of this on location, correct? Am I wrong
all
in that assessment?
Yeah.
All of it in location, right? And it was in Cape Breton, correct?
Yeah.
That you shot it?
I think most. There were maybe like a bar here or there in Halifax. In Sydney.
Sydney, Glace Bay.
Because you really feel a real sense of place. The location stuff, and I'm sure you guys can speak to this, you know, in the many years since, but location work goes so far towards really putting you in the headspace of it feeling lived in and it feeling as though you are in these places rather than being on a soundstage, which inevitably feels very fake. But first of all, as Kenny mentioned, it's beautifully filmed and you get to have all these beautiful wide shots of the fact that you're there. But did it go a long way towards helping your performances in terms of making it feel like you were living in this actual place?
Oh, totally.
Because it does, it just feels like you guys, it does feel like a second skin. You know, Kenny and I talked about one of our favorite scenes in the film is when you drive down the strip.
It's like a block.
And then Lou says, are we supposed to now pretend that they're new guys when we drive back up this block?
Yeah. We pretend they're different guys on the way back.
It's a great scene, and it does feel like these little towns. And I mean, obviously, Halifax is beautiful, Cape Breton's beautiful, but they're, you know, not densely populated. They don't feel like big, bustling places. I also sort of wanted to talk a little bit or ask about there's some pretty intense coming of age emotions that are obviously baked into this film. You guys were relatively close to the ages of the roles. Were you guys kind of dealing with the same stuff that you felt Lou and Mooney were dealing with at the time? Or did you have a little bit of distance from it? What was it like to explore those feelings?
I wasn't in an inappropriate relationship with my high school teacher.
That's good. That's good. That's
good
a plus.
Start. That's a really good place to be.
I had an amazing English and drama teacher, Mr. Spiegel, I just want to give credit where credit's due. Like, I was a first time actor in this movie, but I had a lot of experience from high school drama and being in plays. Sure, and I was, sure, you know, and that was like, that was part of my preparation in life for this part.
Sure.
So I wasn't going through that like Mooney.
Family is very different than Mooney's relationship with her family.
Honestly, I did relate. This might seem small, but living in the suburbs of Toronto and wanting to be part of like the action of the city, I really did feel like an outsider. Today, the concept of Toronto is different. Like, it's just this huge sprawling metropolis. But in the 90s, like growing up in North York, I really felt like I wasn't living the downtown dreams of my life. And I know that sounds small, but like
the downtown dreams.
I had to take.
I need to get in further with you on that at a different topic at a different time.
Well, I had to take the 7C bus down Bathurst like for an hour.
I remember driving you home periodically, and you lived far away.
You can weep about that. That could fuel an emotional scene. So
sure.
So I did recognize that longing, you know, that deep longing that Mooney has for something bigger, something greater
than this.
I really did identify with that.
See, for me, I was living in Vancouver and it was my first time like living on my own. Into going out and exploring my options at that time.
Sure.
And not as worried about what people said about me, shall we say. There's names that you might call that girl. I did actually cheat on my boyfriend while we were shooting.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
Does he know that?
Is this an exclusive?
It doesn't matter. He's married with a kid now. It doesn't matter.
Sure.
So I was definitely dealing with some of the things that
of being around that age for sure
Around that age, because I think I was 19 because I could drink. Legal to drink. I don't think you were legal, or maybe you were legal to drink there.
Are they strict in Halifax though?
Alan Moyle was super strict with me. He was like, and we had, do you remember Bora, our line producer?
Yes.
He was like, on our butts, like, go to bed, go home, go straight home.
Oh my God.
To sleep as soon as you get home.
Oh my.
So they were, you know, they didn't want us to break our leg or go on a bender, obviously.
I was on a bender every night. In that hotel bar. Great. Oh my gosh.
I went straight home. I went straight to sleep because Alan Moyle had told me, he's like, Leanne, you're in almost every scene. This is an extremely demanding task. You have got to have energy. So as soon as the day is over, you go home and you go straight to bed. That's it. And I was very obedient. I never even called my parents for like the first 3 weeks because I was so busy and just going straight to sleep at night. Like I literally didn't. I went home, washed my face, went to sleep. That like my mom called the producer to be like, "What is my daughter okay?"
I've not heard from her.
That's a really good
weeks.
Point, though. You were in every single scene. You didn't. You didn't know what it was going to be like to be working. You know, sometimes 14, 15, 16-hour days.
Yeah,
it takes a lot. And I mean, you were carrying that movie, and they were counting on you, and that was a lot of pressure that maybe you didn't realize at the time. But, you know, I think that the directors and producers were very aware that they needed to protect you and take care of you.
Which is great. I mean, I imagine that there are any number of films where teenagers were not cared for in that way.
And
so it's great to see that they were taking care of you. I wanted to ask about your parental, the actors that play your parents in these films. You know, Tara, you have, you know, Kathy Moriarty playing your mom, which is pretty amazing. I mean, obviously, not to say that Leanne, your parents, both very prominent Canadian actors that were playing your parents. What was the dynamics like with you guys in terms of, you know, on and off camera?
I was just like, I can't believe Kathy Moriarty could be my mother.
Sure.
I was like, hi. But she was also amazing. She like came with a crew of people. She's like, Tara. And she was like always like talking to me like this. She had like a crew of people that like walked around with her everywhere she went. But she was so kind, so nice, was not you know, when you meet like huge actors that are sort of icons in your life and they're total assholes and you're like, oh God, that was so disappointing. She did not let me down. She was incredible. A really nice person. We actually kept in touch for like a couple years after.
Oh, that's so cool.
She was really sweet. The one thing I was sad about, I remember when the movie came out, is a lot of that storyline got cut out, as right. You know, inevitably that those things happen. It just was going to be too complicated and too long, but it was right. It was kind of a nice little storyline, and I was like, ah, damn. But
sure.
I mean, it was just a great experience to work with her and watch her work, and I just spent half the time on set staring at her.
Reasonable, ass. Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
sure. Also,
beautiful. Sure. Beautiful.
Leanne, what was the relationship like with your parents, your fictional parents?
They were wonderful. They were just kind and supportive. And I mean, I didn't realize like how amazing they really were until I like saw the movie and I was like, oh my gosh, they're incredible and hilarious. And I do remember, I think Nicholas Campbell and I, who played my father, went to see a movie together on one of our days off. I think we went to see What Dreams May Come. Is that, wait, hello. Is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's right. That's 98. That makes sense. Yeah.
And it was so weird.
Yeah, it's not a good movie.
And also it's not a good movie to see like the first time you hang out, go with, yeah. Like, it was just too much of a heavy, weird movie. But that's
seeing a movie with someone you don't know that well is very awkward.
It's very weird.
Yeah. Unless the movie's like amazing, right? Yeah. And then like, at least you have that to talk about. But if it's just like What Dreams May Come, you can talk about like, the afterlife, or I mean, that's
oh no, oh god,
it doesn't sound fun. But there, it's interesting, you know. When Kenny and I were breaking down the film, you know, the we obviously believe that your relationship, the Mooney Lou relationship, is hands down the best part of the film. And it's not to say that the other parts don't work as well, but we just wish that the film maybe went more all in with you guys, because like as much as we did enjoy the stuff with your with Mooney's parents, it does sort of feel like, meanwhile, in a different movie, you have this stuff happening. And because you guys were just so great, we just it's if there's a shame to be had, it's that the film didn't sort of dedicate itself to that sort of coming of age narrative, and especially the, as Kenny mentioned, the stuff with Lou and sort of becoming this avenging angel. That stuff is just really, really feels very 2021. So it would have been nice to have seen them run with that a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, these are, it is what it is. But so you guys obviously have worked on many things since, and I guess, you know, and a fair amount of television as well. And I'm sort of curious as to what that experience is like in comparison to the stuff that you've done since. I mean, obviously, Leanne, it was the first thing that you ever did. You had nothing to compare it to, but you now have many films and television stuff to compare it to. And did you, I mean, what was the experience like in comparison?
It will never compare to anything that I have sure. worked on since, because it was a work experience, but it was also a profound life experience. Because, I mean, as Tara touched on, we were teenagers, and it was, for me, it was the first time I was living an independent life, like away from my parents. Sure. I was living in a hotel. I had to get my own meals. Like it was just all new to me. It was like, it was a coming of age, like just being there was me coming of age in a different way. And I remember like being so happy, just feeling like I was creating something. I was working, I was getting paid. I was making something cool. And I was independent, and I felt self-sufficient for the first time. And it was just this tremendous feeling of satisfaction. And one of my favorite memories is just on my days off, like walking through, Cape Breton with a Walkman. And my friend Lucas had made me a mixtape of this new band, Belle and Sebastian. And I was like listening to Belle and Sebastian going for a walk. I think that's kind of when they emerged. Yeah, anyway, walking around, sure. listening to Belle and Sebastian on my Walkman, and like just feeling like really cool.
that might be the most Leanne thing I've ever heard. I mean, the idea of Leanne listening to Belle and Sebastian just zoning out in Cape Breton is just the most. Like that is incredible. That is amazing.
And like, so obviously, no jobs. Every job since then has had. I've been grateful for and I've enjoyed in certain ways, but it's had that feeling of like a job, whereas this had this feeling of like a life event.
Sure, sure.
If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Tara, what about you?
I think for me, there was an innocence about it. I'd never heard of the Toronto Film Festival. I lived in Vancouver. I was still a relatively new actor who wasn't really in that scene or knew about that scene. I just knew I'm going to the East Coast to make a movie. Like a movie. I don't know where it's going to air. Is it going to air on the television? I didn't even think that it was going to be in movie theaters. I thought like movie of the week or something that'll be on CBC or that's what I thought. And so when we went to Toronto, I was like, what's the Toronto Film Festival?
Right.
And it was just so weird. And but there was a beautiful innocence about it that I don't think I will ever get back ever again. Now that I've been around and I'm jaded and but I understand the industry and I see it through different eyes. That was the first time I saw it through those eyes. And there was something really beautiful about that. Just being in the moment and not thinking ahead or of anything else, really.
Well, guys, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and talk about this film. And Leanne, obviously, it's always a pleasure to chat with you about anything. But just in general, I mean, this is a movie that I don't know. It's a real time capsule for me, and it took me back. And I'm just so happy to have been able to kind of walk through this with you.
Sure. Thank you, Phil. It was really a pleasure to reconnect. I mean, and talk about this experience that was really profound for Tara and I that we really haven't had the opportunity to share about.
I know. And I keep telling Trisha, I was like, let's revisit it. Where are Mooney and Lou now?
Yeah. There's a lot going on in this movie, and you know, as our listeners will hear the previous 90 minutes or so of Kenny and I expounding about it and sort of unpacking it, there's a lot of really prescient stuff going on in it and some really beautiful, I mean, obviously your performances are tremendous, but there's a lot, it's a little scattershot, it's a little over the place, but it's doing a lot of things that I think are interesting and that weren't really being done at the time.
I thank you for mentioning that, Phil, because I really do want to take a minute while we're here to highlight Trisha Fish, because none of this would exist without her screenplay. And in so many ways, it's brilliant. Some things, as you mentioned, haven't aged as perfectly,
but it was
an extremely avant-garde film at the time, because I mean, it was feminist in so many ways. It was two female leads. It was the female experience, which is still underrepresented. So looking back on that being my first film, it's one of the best things I've ever worked on, you know, like having the opportunity to inhabit a real girl and have it be her story.
Yeah. But it's also like, talk about two female leads, a female writer, two female producers. It was a very female heavy project to be on. And I think I agree. Like, it was, what an honor for that to be the first experience for you, especially.
It's a very special movie, and it's doing a lot of stuff that, and it's an underseen film too. I mean, it's a movie that we really hope more people will take the time to seek out. It's currently, if you live in the States, it's currently streaming on Amazon Prime. So there is that, but we'd love more people to see it. And you know, I think I speak for Kenny as well when I say thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you guys.
I loved it. This was so much fun.
It was a pleasure. It was fun.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits.
We're also on Twitter at Podcast Like It's 1999. We're also on Instagram at Podcast Like It's 1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.